some incentives to stay in business. What we want to do is come down here and try to work with the duck clubs to find about, I'm going to say, 2,000 to 4,000 acres that we can acquire in fee title to restore about a quarter to half of that to wetlands. We'll end up having to dedicate, I don't want to say the word having to dedicate, that's probably the wrong way to say it. We'll dedicate probably half of that ground to upland management to facilitate T&E recovery for the suite of endangered species that probably drive what people do down here, as well as do a wetland footprint to help move birds from Kern Refuge, where they predominantly sit, to establish a flight corridor out into this area that helps improve their hunting. And then work to develop landowners that want to enter into long-term easements with the department will work in that area. But that footprint will probably be somewhere in the, I'm going to say 10 to 15, maybe 20,000 acre footprint. A large percentage of that footprint will be upland habitat to meet the T&E needs. There's another gentleman that I work with, Steve Juarez, that's in Sacramento today, working on endangered species issues. It's his job to do K-rats, it's my job to do wetlands, and it's both of our jobs to figure out how to get along. So, and what Steve and I will do, we'll develop that footprint and the mosaic to restore the wetlands, and then at the same time have a T&E footprint out here that the endangered species world and meets, you know, reasonable recovery. And then up in north of here, about 15 miles, there's an area that's kind of transitional to this area that was all but forgotten. And it's called the Burl area, the Wheatville area. It's at the lower end of the Kings River system in the sloughs and channels that ultimately on the Kings River that entered the Mendota area. There's a large presence of WRP lands up there already. There's an opportunity for us to actually work to acquire some lands as well as some water rights off the Kings River system, and also potentially to do some off-stream storage where we can work with people and actually create some usable water that maybe we can move around to get to some other people in the state. One of the things that I'm doing a lot is trying to figure out where there are opportunities for us to work with ag or work with water districts to do projects that not only help them become stable in their loss of water in the San Joaquin Valley, but at the same time generate yields that we can move for our environmental needs. And that's probably where there's a lot of challenge and a lot of opportunity right now.
Is this Bowman's property here?
This is actually owned by Donald Hare.
Where's Bowman's at?
Bowman's was back there.
Where he has his pheasant club too?
Yeah, he's doing pretty good on his wild pheasants there. I think it's kind of kept his duck hunters happy the last couple of years.
He gets birds from the county, too.
Yeah, I think that's how they got started, wasn't it?
Right.
The County Fishing Game Commission. Mm-hmm. Yeah, unfortunately, pheasants have been extirpated across a lot of the, southern San Joaquin Valley. And, Bob should put the right habitat out and get a few started again. Take off.
Just to give you an idea how big this area is, the lake is, I just noticed in the Corcoran Highway is that power line out there. Interstate 5 is another 30 miles west of that power line. And the lake itself actually went almost up within probably a half mile of I-5.
Oh, wow.
And that's how big the footprint of Tulare Lake was when it was here. And I don't know if you guys know where Kern Refuge is. But I actually took an airboat from Kern Refuge to the Jack in the Box at Buttonwillow in 78.
Tomorrow, when we're at our commission meeting, they're out in the lobby of the supervisor's chambers.
They got the old maps.
Old 1886 map. Remind me tomorrow. We'll look. It'll show the footprint, the 1886 footprint of the lake. It's on the wall. It's one of the best you can.
The congressman's brother.
Really?
Dan Dooley, he's got a set of those maps that I've seen in his office that is pretty spectacular.
Tell me about the planning you'd have to do working with the community and interest groups. You bought the land or you've got an agreement with the landowner and now it's time to design a wetland. How complicated or not is it to plan and what are all the stakeholders
it,
for?
You know, it can be very complicated or it can be very simple, depending on, you know, what the circumstances are, what the program, the, you know, how it's all being done. Probably the most complicated is some of the stuff that's going on with CalFed in terms of, you know, restoration things in the Delta and, you know, a myriad of environmental, you know, policy, regulation, things that have to be worked through one by one, and it can take years and years to restore a wetland. Out here, I got to be honest with you, this is pretty straightforward, simple stuff. This is one farm bill program
that
is private property. Landowner's eligible to enroll if it was previously wetland. It's a, you know, had to be a former wetland. This, they come out and do a soil test. Yep, former wetland here. If you want to enroll us in a program, we'll give you a biological score, and then we'll rank yours against others statewide. And if we get enough money, it, you know, right, you want to participate, let's do it. They
how many acres are you restoring, Chris? How many acres are you restoring?
I'm not
understanding. Okay, just check.
The, but anyway, the you know, the interesting thing about
that was evil.
He's
sorry.
He's still despoiled.
I'm sorry. You still like that government bio. They're still subsidizing your
farmers. That's right.
You're Kentucky bluegrass.
That's right. That's right.
The interesting thing about WRP is that you know, Larry Norris, the local biologist down here, is really, I mean, he's the guy that deserves more credit than anybody for the work that's happened here. He and Bowman have kind of teamed up, and, you know, Bowman's contacts with the community, with the other farmers around here, is really, it's kind of spread word of mouth, you know, to be honest with you. And, but they've, that program has, because it's been successful, it's got on the ground in a relatively, you know, timely manner. They've, it'll take them 6 months maybe from the time that a property's offered until they can, you know, make it a decision as to whether they can roll it in a program. And usually another 6 months after that, they've got escrow closed on the easement. And another year after that, it's you know, done and ready for water.
I'll tell you something, from a farmer's perspective, I mean, the best thing that they could have done out here, the best thing that Bob did is actually put one in.
Yeah.
And then bring his friends around and show, look.
Yeah.
Look how this really works. Exactly. Look how I did it. And here's how I did it. And here's the hoops I had to jump through.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, you're just seeing this thing explode from the start down here.
And that's really, you know, Dean and I, in our private land, you know, habitat program, you know, efforts, That's probably the one lesson that we've learned, is that you can talk and talk and plan and do all this for all day long, but if you can get something on the ground and take somebody out and show it to them, it speaks volumes for what you want to do. And that's kind of what we did with this the commission approving that brood pond money and letting us put 130 acres over here is what's really going to allow us to get the $750,000 federal money.
I worked with the Department of Interior and I heard about the funding and watched the Ag Bill and the Farm Bill lobbied for sod muster and, you know, water, you know, renewal program. But I've never seen one restored, and that was good to see.
Yeah.
The lands that Larry's working on up in the, it's called the Wheatville Rural Area, there's one landowner that's dedicated 6,500 acres to WRP. And there's two other landowners. I mean, this transition out of farming in taking. It's the land between Westlands and the Kings River Water Authority. And there's one, two, three, four other landowners to the tune of about 1,500 to 2,000 landowners per project that are standing in line to sign up to go into WRP.
Yeah, and that's what it is. Most of the growers are always, I mean, they're offering their most marginal ground. They're keeping their best land in production. And that's what we feel, you know, that's the best.
The other thing that makes it a piece of cake to do wetland restoration with private landowners is it's not, I mean, we're helping, but it's their restoration, it's their decision making, it's not agency decision making, it's not an agency coming in as a landowner neighbor saying we're going to change the landscape.
And the landowners are, the contract, you know, the guy that owns that piece of equipment right there, the contract's between the landowner and the equipment and the equipment, you know, guy. And so it makes it pretty
smooth. You don't have to worry about that kind of stuff.
No, we got to keep an overall management plan, you know, kind of what needs to be done, but it's up to them to
explain the technique of this. Well, you've got this earth mover out here. I mean, was there stakes put out here and survey put out here, or did the guy just stop?
No, absolutely. It's all
explain how that's done.
Basically, when we start a restoration project, I've been involved in, you know, quite a few of these things over the years. You essentially develop a, you know, survey of the property first, figure out what the fall is from one end of the field to the other and so forth. And then eventually take that and put it into develop some elevations that you want to see, you know, your ultimately you want to have your water surface elevation to be, mm-hmm. your levees need to be, you know, have a certain amount of freeboard, usually a foot or foot and a half of freeboard above that. And stakes are set, you know, all those design elements are kind of put on the map, everybody agrees to it, and then it's all staked out. And
you look at the islands, you see the islands that are going to be out in here.
The car shows, right?
Yeah, and the paddle wheel scraper, you know, is the most effective piece of equipment because you can pick up large volume of dirt and move it around.
They'll come in there and ditch us a little bit like they did down there.
Yeah.
And what happens, the cuts where they have to cut to create the channels, I mean, this is a flat piece of farm ground, so the cuts to become the channels become the fill, it either becomes the levees or the island.
Yeah.
One thing we've really learned in the last decade, when I first started with the department in 93, at that time, the wetland restoration technique mainly was build levee around the field.
Fill it up.
Yeah.
Fill it up. That's right.
And that took about enough dirt to build one little channel through the middle of the field or two, you know, or something. And that was it. And 90% of the rest of the pond bottom was still flat. So what happened when you put water on, you grew wetland plants, you grew all of one wetland plant, usually water grass or something, chest high. Well, you thought, God, what a great food crop. But it wasn't very diverse, didn't have different water depths, didn't have different veg communities, and quite often, you know, didn't get as, you know, very real good bird use, except for at night, of course, when landowners weren't interested in duck use at night, you know. And so over the years, we've really moved into this, we call it de-leveling, which, you know, putting as much topography into these wetlands as possible. And it's hard to see right now, but when the water goes on this, you'll see that there's a lot of ups and downs, little hummocks and swales and potholes and stuff out there. And that's really what a wetland historically was like. You didn't have level, you know, laser-leveled fields historically. You know?
Actually, a really good beginning point to see how that mosaic should look. And if you fly over this valley, even a cotton field that's in production, you can still see where those historic channels were. You can see where the soil type changes. And you can almost just take those aerial photos, superimpose where you want your channels, and then build your islands off of that.
Yeah, that's a pretty common technique, actually.
I mean, the signature on the ground, it's uncanny that the signature on the ground is still so tight.
Yeah. Well, let's take one last stop down here. We'll show you a relatively new restoration, a couple years old, and it's really going to crank out some benefits this year.
You want us all to back out ahead of you?
No, we're
going to
turn around.
Bob, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Sandy said to tell you
how Sandy did. Day to day, because this is, you know, in our way of thinking, this is kind of the best of all worlds right here in terms of a habitat complex during the spring and summer. What we're looking at behind us here is a really good upland nesting field. And so all these birds you see, you know, out here, the ducks in particular, are going to go over here in the grass and, you know, build a nest and, you know, have a nice brood pond here, you know, to be available to raise their ducklings all summer. And so there's kind of a, you know, with wetland restoration, we can often talk about the wetlands because, you know, you can see the birds and there's water out there and, you know, that's the most obvious, you know, thing to draw people's attention. But the upland habitat is, in many cases, equally important. And in this complex of habitat here in Alpaw, we've got, like Dean said, you know, about 60% wetlands and 40% upland. And, you know, for these breeding birds, they got to have a place to nest.
You know? Good. I mean, that gives the pheasants a chance.
And so the one thing I wanted to mention, one of the efforts that we've been involved in here for the last 3 or 4 years has been there's a Farm Bill conservation program called CRP, which, you know, many of you guys may be familiar with from hunting trips around the Midwest or whatever, South Dakota. And anyway, we've been working on trying to bring CRP to California in meaningful acreages for the last few years. And our relationship with USDA right now through the Wetland Reserve Program, I think, has given us some additional, you know, bridges there. But one of the things that we would ultimately like to see is we would like to see CRP be a part of this same landscape, of this wetland, you know, cropland landscape, to provide what we're looking at behind us here.
CRP dollars would provide a kind of dollars to create
upland. Exactly. The upland component in these wetland systems, you know. And so there's some opportunities there right now. The one thing that keeps CRP from working in California is that there's a $40 an acre, you know, that's the average payment's only $40 an acre in California, because that's based on dry land
soil rental rates, you know, and California dealing with irrigated ag land, rental cash rents, you know, I don't know, what is it down here, 150 or 200, you know, around the state. And so so we haven't competed very well for CRP acreage. We got almost none in the Central Valley. We put together a little pilot project in the Sacramento Valley called CREP, California CREP. You know, we're getting some acreage enrolled in that. And it's, you know, look, wildlife benefits are looking to be pretty significant. But we would like to ultimately push USDA to look at California in a little different light, spread their money from the Midwest out here, you know, and I think the states in the East that are trying to do the same, and make CRP a viable land use option for landowners right along with things like WRP. And the thing with CRP is it's only a 10-year program, so some folks that are unwilling to dedicate farmland forever to wetlands might participate in CRP for a term program. And, you know, if it's done in the same areas as some of these wetlands, the benefits could be outstanding. But that's my little pitch on Farm Bill stuff. And, you know,
is there any Prop 40 money that you guys have gone after because of CRP?
Yeah, there's a couple different pots of money. We haven't really got our hands on too much Prop 40, but we're looking at some Prop 50 ag wildlife money that's tied to the CalFed Ecosystem Restoration Program. And we're thinking about maybe using that sort of as a seed to do some of these things with CRP or with
Quip. Hasn't directly received any money, but both DU and CWA have helped with restoration and enhancement projects. In fact, CWA has a $1 million NACA grant working with the duck clubs in and around Kern Refuge, helping to improve levees, install new water control structures, upgrade pumps, put in pipelines to help conserve water. And it's worked real well because CWA has come in and kind of done the enhancement work, and we've layered our program on top of that to help with the habitat management.
The DU has done the same thing. That all the work that's being done to restore habitat in the Goose Lake Bottom south of Highway 46, that's being coordinated through DU. I mean, DU's working with those landowners in WRP.
I see where DU gets quite a bit of money from Wildlife Conservation Board also.
Well, they get money to go to those landowners. What happens is we'll work and develop the project, and to get the money out to the landowner, it's an efficient way to move it from WCB to the landowner, and then we get the commitment from the landowner.
And you need to get some of their dollars, though.
Well, when we get... and then we get the engineering and DU's expertise in engineering and restoration to help us as well.
Yeah, we've got a good working relationship with both organizations. There's no doubt. Each of them has their strengths. You know, they're both DU is very effective in national legislative, you know, congressional, you know, efforts in D.C. on farm bill programs and so forth. CWA does a great job in the California legislature, and you know, they contribute expertise, and they're just a partner. You know, a lot of times we can't get things done because we're a government agency that we can get done by, you know, working with CWA or DU or some of the other groups. And I really think they both bring, you know, plenty to the table.
And, you know, one of the things that I told Dave, that I asked him if he said that, the thing that, something that's really important to keep in perspective in this landscape and all the other private landscape that's in the valley, it's, and I sometimes use the word insanity drive from the people that duck hunt, but it's this passion of waterfowling that gets the Bowmans and the people that have the Tulare or the Kern Wasco duck clubs and the Goose Lake Bottom, that private land and the amount of money they put into that, they don't ever want to tell their wives what a duck costs them. And it's that hunting ethic. If waterfowling and pheasant hunting wasn't a part of this landscape, this WRP project wouldn't be here. You know, and the same goes for the grasslands area where I've worked most of my career. But it's that passion that gets these guys wanting to do this. I mean, the program's there, but it's the them thinking about where they're going to be in the middle of the winter.
And likewise, you know, that's part of the reason we've put such an emphasis on private lands, you know, conservation programs, because the programs like WRP and like CRP are, you know, perpetuating our hunting heritage, you know, in my way of thinking. They're providing habitat, they're allowing landowners to economically viable manner put habitat on the ground and take their kids hunting and spend time outdoors and
you know, do things that are going to result in people wanting to continue hunting, you know, several generations down the road. And, you know, we can do a lot on our own lands, wildlife areas, refuges, and making, you know, those uses available. But I think it's equally important to support a, you know, a vibrant, you know, landscape that involves, you know, habitat and farming and landowners participating in these programs. So. That's all we kind of got today. I hope.
I'm for it.
Thank you. Anytime you guys have any questions, you know, Dean and I are available. To John, I'm sure, you know, we're happy to kind of fill you in. I know these a lot of these programs and stuff. It's confusing to keep all that straight as to where money's coming from and all that.
Well, we want to say thank you to you guys, too, for supporting our programs through supplying us with the duck stamp funding, because a lot of what we do, we couldn't do without the duck stamp funding.
That's right.
That's great.
Yeah.
Thanks
a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.